Good afternoon. Welcome to this special Thursday afternoon edition of Rockin' the Boat. It's August 2nd, 2001, and my name is the V-Man. I'm filling in this time for Mr. Mookie and his Kiss My Freak speech, which will be back next Thursday at 2 p.m. In the meantime, stand by for Rockin' the Boat. This special afternoon edition will be discussing the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, journalist, African-American, death row prisoner in Pennsylvania for over 20 years. We'll be talking about the newest updates on his case, recent court filings, and recent decisions handed down and what effect that will have, as well his current appearance to happen August 17th in Philadelphia. We'll be joined by Monica Moorhead of the International Action Center on today's program in just a little while. So stay tuned to 96.3 Free Mumia Radio.
Fastest-growing public housing tract in America. In 1981, I was a reporter for WUHY-FM and president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. Currently, I'm a writer and public radio commentator. I've been a resident on Pennsylvania's death row for more than 15 years. Tune in to hear my regular reports from death row. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Florida should as a neon sign on a Las Vegas strip at night. Neither the Party of Lincoln nor the Party of Working Families gave much of a damn about the thousands of African-Americans, Haitians, or even Jewish voters who were brutally disenfranchised during the recent presidential elections. That fact, in addition to being disturbing, is just plain curious. Why would any political party remain virtually silent when its members are denied the fundamental right to vote? Doesn't that sound, well, crazy? Political scientists have determined that the parties, especially the Democrats, are so compromised by the divergent interests of its members, who come from differing social and class strata, that the party doesn't really want new, poor, or working class members as party voters. Francis Fox Piven and Richard Clarke, in their excellent The New Class War, have determined that party leaders have no real interest in expanding the party, especially at the social bottom. They write, "If the Democratic leadership was unwilling in the past to risk the internal disruption caused by a massive inflow of new voters, it's less willing today. Developments over the last two decades have made new voters more politicized and more contentious. The role of big business contributors in the party has grown. And finally, party professionals, determined to recapture the control that they lost as a result of the McGovern reforms, have not wanted to enlarge and politicize a class-based electoral constituency." Historian Manning Marable described the Clinton years as one of liberal republicanism. In this sense, the silence surrounding Florida seems somewhat reasonable. For if the party had really fought for the interests of thousands of African-Americans, Haitians, and Jews in Palm Beach, Hillsborough, and other counties, they would have energized and indeed enlarged the pool of new voters. That is precisely what party bigwigs do not want. The silence around Florida is a profound betrayal of the tens of thousands who were disenfranchised there. Their silence signifies their acceptance of your disenfranchisement. Would you then reward such a betrayal? If you accept such an indignity, then you are. You're demonstrating that violating your rights are acceptable. Neither party deserves to profit from your indignity. Declare your independence from such a political obstruction. As more and more folks declare themselves as independents, the hollow, rotten insides of the two corporate parties just wither away. Then, perhaps these political hyenas won't be able to make their annual pilgrimages to the inner cities to promise you the moon, only to deliver space dust. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And you are indeed tuned into 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. And this afternoon, we're going to be talking about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a case that is not just about the persecution of one individual. Mumia Abu-Jamal is considered to be the most recognizable face of the death penalty and an example of the injustice inherent to the criminal court justice system in America overall. In May, after a series of legal maneuverings in which Mumia retained a new legal team, new testimony was presented to the courts, which implicated another man, Arnold Beverly, in the murder of police officer Daniel Faulkner. On July 19, 2001, Federal District Court Judge William H. Yon Jr. issued a 13-page ruling in which he turned down a petition filed by the new legal counsel representing Mumia. As well, Mumia will be appearing in a state court hearing in Philadelphia on August 17, 2001. To discuss some of these developments, we're going to be joined by Monica Moorhead of the International Action Center in New York City. Monica is a national coordinator of the Millions for Mumia campaign to demand a new trial for Mumia Abu-Jamal. In 1996, she interviewed him on death row in Pennsylvania. Monica is also a contributing editor to the Workers' World newspaper and was that party's candidate for president in the 2000 election. Monica Moorhead, I want to welcome you to Free Radio. All right. That sounds good there. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. The first question I have, Monica, we've had a lot of discussion over the years about Mumia's case, and I just want to give some of our newer listeners, possibly people tuning in and hearing about this case for the first time, just a thumbnail sketch of what the case is about, what happened on the night of December 9th, 1981 in Center City, Philly, and how the new confession, the revelation of this confession, comes in to the scene.
Well, on December 9th, 1981, Mumia Abu-Jamal, who at the time was moonlighting as a cab driver, but was also still very much a revolutionary journalist who had a history of exposing police brutality in Philadelphia, especially under the fascistic Rizzo years of the 70s and early 80s, he happened to come upon his brother being assaulted by a police officer. And in this case, it was Daniel Faulkner. And what happened was is that a struggle ensued, and Daniel Faulkner was shot twice, and so was Mumia. And this is where the whole controversy about what happened, you know, and subsequently the trial of Mumia Abu-Jamal occurred. And he was falsely accused of killing Daniel Faulkner, who happened to be white, and sentenced to die on July 3rd, 1982, is when he was convicted of this capital punishment trial. And since 1982, Mumia has become a world-renowned figure in terms of being victimized by the racist death penalty in this country, along with police brutality. And he's always claimed his innocence. But because of how the trial was conducted in 1982, the fact that he had ineffective counsel in the form of Anthony Jackson, the fact that the judge who oversaw the trial was a member of the Fraternal Order of Police, Hanging Judge Sable, made no effort to hide this. He was very hostile towards Mumia. Of course, the prosecutor put Mumia on trial not because they had any credible evidence to convict Mumia, but because he was a Black Panther. He had been a Black Panther since the time he was 15, and the prosecutor actually put his political beliefs on trial, and it was so much constitutional violations that took place, you know, during this trial. The fact that Black jurors were one by one were illegally dismissed from taking place, from taking part in the jury trial of Mumia, the suppressed evidence that took place, the fact that Mumia had a certain caliber gun and Faulkner was fatally shot by another caliber of gun. All of these different factors played into this, really the sham of a trial that took place against Mumia. And because Faulkner was a policeman, and we know how much hysteria is whipped up, you know, around the country in terms of if any police officer is shot under any circumstances, that most of the time you automatically get the death penalty. And this was very much the case for Mumia. And a progressive movement, has taken shape over the last 20 years in support of Mumia Abu-Jamal, because so many people, and especially a lot of young people, recognize the fact that not only was he victimized and persecuted because he's a revolutionary, but also he has come to symbolize everything that's terribly wrong in this country, especially when you talk about racist repression. So that in a nutshell sort of explains what happened to Mumia in terms of how he was railroaded to death row in Pennsylvania. I should also mention that there were two post-conviction Relief Act hearings that took place in 1995 and 1996 following the state conviction of Mumia. And at these post-conviction hearings, some of those witnesses who falsely testified against Mumia, witnesses like Cynthia White and Veronica Jones and William Singletary, who on the night of December 9th, 1981, were somewhere within the vicinity of where this killing took place, during the original trial, they gave false testimony against Mumia. So at this post-conviction hearing, some of these same witnesses came forth to say that they had lied during that original trial. And the reason why they gave false testimony against Mumia is because They were pressured, they were bullied, they were coerced into giving false testimony against Mumia because of pressure by the Fraternal Order of Police.
I'd also like to quickly mention that proceeding you're talking about in 1996 was also presided over by Judge Albert Sabo.
He was actually brought out of retirement. He had already retired from the bench, and he was brought out of retirement to oversee once again this post-conviction hearing. And once again, he threw out all of this. He threw out the testimony of these witnesses.
This is a man who was involved in the Fraternal Order of Police himself, and also a former officer with the Philadelphia Police Department.
Absolutely, and he sent more people to death row than any other judge in the country. That's why they call him Hanging Judge Albert Sabo. So this is sort of the background of Mumia's case, and as you can imagine, a lot has happened.
A lot has happened. This is a difficult case to keep up with. So much goes on sometimes.
Yes.
Listeners may remember in 1999, a second death warrant was signed for Mumia Abu-Jamal, and mass protests hit the streets in reaction to that. And it was subsequently stayed. The legal team at that time filed a habeas corpus petition. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was a writ of habeas corpus petition that was filed on October 15th. 1999 before the federal district court. This was the first level of the federal appeals process that was open to Mumia following the rejection of his appeals by the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court. They rejected his appeal not once but twice, and that's when Governor Ridge signed really the second death warrant against Mumia, because the first death warrant was signed on August 17, 1995. And 5 days before he was scheduled to be executed, the International Action Center and International Concern Family and Friends, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and other organizations around the country called an emergency mobilization in Philadelphia on August 12, 1995, and over 10,000 people came out in Philadelphia to demand that there be no execution of Mumia and to demand that a new trial be held. And we were able to push Ridge back then, and we were also able to push him back in October of 1999 when, again, he tried to sign a death warrant, and we had threatened to go to Philadelphia and take it over and just stay, you know, until this execution order was rescinded, and it was rescinded. So now this writ of habeas corpus is now before the federal district judge, William Yon, and what this writ of habeas corpus is all about is that it outlines the 29 constitutional violations that took place during Mumia's original trial. It doesn't really deal with factual evidence. It deals with the 29 constitutional violations, the most prominent being the fact that Mumia was provided with ineffective counsel and was not able to represent himself or to have the counsel of his choice during that original trial, along with the other violations. So it's like 260 pages or more that outline all of the constitutional violations. So so the movement and Mumia have been waiting for almost 2 years for Judge Yon to rule on whether Mumia will have the right to an evidentiary hearing.
And that would be in a federal court, that hearing.
That would be in the federal court, to allow all of the suppressed evidence that wasn't allowed during the original trial to come up during this trial.
Potentially with a jury or with a set of judges?
No, this will be before. This will not be before. This is not a trial.
Okay, it's just a hearing.
It will be a hearing, and Judge Yon would be really the one to decide.
To listen to the evidence to decide whether or not to have a real trial.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I see.
Absolutely.
Because sometimes all these court proceedings are kind of confusing, and recently Judge Yan issued another ruling. But before we get to that, we should talk a little bit about some of the more somewhat distant history with the legal team. Mumia filed earlier this year in March, I believe. Mumia filed papers to dismiss his former legal team of Leonard Weinglass, Dan Williams, and others who had been working on his case for almost a decade.
Since 1995.
Since 1995, okay.
Mm-hmm. Since the first post-conviction hearing.
That's when they took it over?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And could we talk a bit about some of that now? What do you surmise? I mean, we all understand it was about a book that Dan Williams wrote that talked about some of the evidence that has now since come to light regarding you know, suppressed statements and the confession of Arnold Beverly. Mm-hmm. Talk a bit about, you know, why Mumia chose to fire his legal team, though. I mean, a lot of people are somewhat confused by that decision.
Yes, and from what we can surmise, the reason why Mumia did this, which we, you know, we support whatever his whatever legal team he wants to have, and from what we can understand, it was really basically a difference over legal strategy
mm-hmm.
as to why Mumia decided to dismiss this legal team and hire a new legal team. It was really purely a question of legal strategy. Mumia wanted to go in one direction, and they wanted to go in another direction. And this has been going on for quite a while. This just didn't happen over the question of the book,
right.
The Dan Williams book, which we feel is very, very unfortunate that he would do something like this, especially Mumia had no prior knowledge.
At this crucial time.
At this crucial time. And I've just seen certain sections of the book, but the fact that, you know, Williams talks very negatively about the movement that has been supporting Mumia all of these last two decades. I mean, it's been the movement that's been decisive.
Yeah.
Not the legal, but it's been the political movement that's been decisive in terms of keeping Mumia alive, in terms of stopping the execution. And for someone to attack the movement as being like fringe, quote unquote, you know, it's appalling. It's irresponsible and it's dangerous in terms of not only Mumia's individual situation, but for the, you know, entire movement as well. So I think it was a question of legal strategy, and the International Action Center's view is that no one should ever second-guess Mumia in terms of whatever decision he makes, because he is a brilliant jailhouse lawyer.
That's true.
He's brilliant.
And it's his life.
It is his life. You know, so, whatever legal decision he decides to make, it should not divert attention away from what we as activists have to do. We have to do everything possible to unite as many people as possible around this case, because it represents so many important issues that are vital to our movement. And that's what we're mainly concerned about. We have no control over the legal situation. We have no control over the legal situation. Right. It is not our arena of struggle. It's important for us to understand what's going on legally with Mumia's case. Which takes a lot of time and, you know, it can be very confusing, as you pointed out. But once we do that, then we really need to buckle down and become very, very focused on what we need to do. Our expertise of struggle is, you know, politically. You know, how are we going to reach out to millions of people who still don't know about Mumia's case? How are we going to really break into the media who have the mainstream media, which has really carried out a conspiracy to try to keep this confession by Arnold Beverly, who confessed that he was the one who was hired by the mob to get rid of Faulkner. You know, this alone should be front page news.
Yeah.
It should be all over the front pages of the news. You know, and this Effective Death Penalty Act, the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act, is such a dangerous piece of legislation, because basically what it says is that it doesn't matter whether you're innocent or not. It doesn't matter whether you're innocent or not. If a trial was carried out with no procedural violations, then, you know, no judge is obligated to look at new factual evidence or even constitutional violations. And this is what Mumia is up against in the federal court. This is what any death row inmate is up against in the federal courts.
And now Judge Yon, in his ruling last month, cited this Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act in ruling against hearing new evidence, new statements from not only Arnold Beverly, but also Mumia himself for the first time, and his brother William Cook, and two other potential witnesses to various aspects of the case. Lynn Washington was a journalist, and another man, his name slips me, but he was involved with an FBI plot to cover up crimes by the Philadelphia police in the area at the time, graft and payoffs and prostitution and whatnot that was going on. Talk about Judge Yon's ruling and how he used the Anti-Terrorism Act, and what effect it has on the case overall.
Well, as you pointed out, Judge Yon on July 19th refused to enter into evidence the Beverly affidavit. He refused to add it on to the original writ of habeas corpus that was first filed by Linda Wineglass and Dan Williams on October 15th, 1999. And so, he cited the Effective Death Penalty Act as the main reason why he would not add this on to the writ of habeas corpus. He pointed out that, first of all, the deadline for adding this affidavit, the deadline for adding this affidavit onto the writ of habeas corpus had already expired. That if Mumia was going to do this as the petitioner, he should have done it no later than June 8th, 2000. So he cited that as an excuse not to add on the writ of habeas, to add on this affidavit. And he also cited the Herrera case, which I think was a very historic case during the 1990s, which once again points out that innocence of a person takes back seat to any procedural guidelines. So he pointed that out. He also stated that because Mumia's new lawyer cited that there was clearly a conspiracy on the part of the prosecution during the original trial to suppress, you know, any evidence to show that Mumia was innocent. And so Yon said, well, there's no evidence, both either conscious or unconscious, to prove this. Well, why not? There certainly is factual evidence, but if you're going to use something like the Effective Death Penalty Act, you know, you're not even obligated, you know, to even look at this new evidence.
Right.
So these are some of the issues that he raises in this ruling, and in this July 19th ruling. And he also stated that the state courts are not even obligated to look at this factual evidence, much less the federal courts. So he's actually telling the state courts what to do with this Beverly affidavit, which is really not his place to do that. So he's violating his own authority in doing this. So these are some of the excuses that he cites. The Statue of Limitations that is outlined in the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act.
A statute of limitations for new evidence?
Requesting, you know, this new evidence be entered.
This man confessed to murder. There's no statute of limitations on murder.
Right, exactly.
Wow. That's shocking.
It's really incredible. And then he also stated that based on, you know, the Effective Death Penalty Act again, you know, it's very, very unlikely that Mumia will be granted an evidentiary hearing. I mean, he actually said, you know, he indicated that.
Wow.
In this ruling. So Mumia being in court on August 17th, which is not the federal district court, but now his case is back in the state courts.
Is that as a result of this ruling by
Yon?
No,
that's not a result of this ruling.
Okay,
it's
this
a
is
result
a separate
of another,
action.
Another okay. legal briefing, either, I'm sorry, legal brief
okay.
that the new lawyers filed with the state courts. This is a 300-plus page brief that outlines, quote-unquote, the ineffective counsel of Leonard Weinglass and Dan Williams during the Post-Conviction Relief Act hearings.
Okay.
And based on all of the examples that they gave of, for instance, during that conviction, post-conviction hearing, there was nothing entered into the record stating that Mumia was innocent. There was nothing said, no claim of innocence that was entered into record during those post-conviction hearings. So this is something that the lawyers made a really big deal of, you know, in this 300-plus page brief that was filed the same day. It was filed on May 4th,
okay.
2001, the same day that Mumia's lawyers officially became his lawyers.
Okay, right. That was back in May when the new testimonies came forward as well.
Exactly. Those were affidavits, Mumia's new lawyers, and also this brief. So based on this, the state courts, this is at the Justice Center in Philadelphia, they gave Mumia this court date of Friday, August 17th, to hear oral arguments. This is not to really decide, you know, anything, but it's to begin oral arguments over the question of whether Mumia is going to be granted another post-conviction Relief Act hearing.
Okay, in the state, at the state level. Okay, based on the evidence of the Beverly confession and the other statements.
Right, and the claim of innocence.
Okay, okay, yes. So that's a little more clear to me and hopefully to our listeners. So right. What does the International Action Center and International Concern Family and Friends and the other mobilizations that have come together, what is being planned for Philadelphia on the 17th around the world?
Well, we're planning an all-out mobilization for August 17th. Every activist who can make it to Philadelphia at 9 a.m., this is when Mumia is going to be in court.
He is going to be in court.
He's going to be in court.
Is he going to be testifying?
We really don't know.
Okay.
We don't know what's actually going to take place in that court. Most likely he will not be, but he does have the right to hear the oral arguments. And the fact that he's going to be in court is just, I can't explain how important and how significant that is, because he has not been in court for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
He has not been in any court for 5 years. So this is a historic event that is taking place. And we are mobilizing buses from New York and Boston and Baltimore, all over the country, but especially the East Coast, to be in Philadelphia, to pack the courtroom and to pack outside in City Hall, where we expected like an all day vigil demonstration. It's going to be a rally, speeches. There's going to be informational tables set up with all Mamiya's, all the different columns that he's written on various social issues here and around the world. There's something called Honk for Mamiya, which International Concerned Family and Friends and International Action Center in Philadelphia do every Monday so people can honk their support for Mamiya on the streets of Philadelphia. So it's going to be like an all-day event in Philadelphia while Mamiya is in court. And depending on what comes out of if any ruling comes out of the courts on the 17th, there very well may be a demonstration held on Saturday, August 18th, to sort of orient the movement as to what took place in court the day before and what the follow-up activities are going to be following the 17th.
And I'll give listeners information for local events that are planned for the Bay Area and for Santa Cruz after we're off the phone. Monica, I want to ask you if there's anything that you feel we haven't gone over, if you want to add anything to this discussion, and also give us some contact information for how people can plug into the movement to Free Mamiya, and let us know what the International Action Center contact numbers are as well.
Okay. Well, I just think that... especially for the general public who don't know anything about Mamiya and may feel, well, this doesn't concern me, you know, this is just an isolated situation, isolated case. Nothing could be further from the truth. If the state, if this repressive state, that is the prisons and the courts and the police, etc., if they're allowed to execute someone like Mamiya, that what that means is that there could be no justice for anybody. Anybody who has a different view, anybody who has a different political belief, anybody who comes out and dares to speak out against any injustice in this society will be vulnerable. And could be just taken off the streets, can be arrested for anything, can be framed up, can be thrown in jail without, you know, any legal recourse. And so this is what Mamiya's case is really all about. He's one of 3,600 people on death row, and most of the people on death row are people of color and poor people. And this is who people of color and poor people are the ones who fill up the prisons in this country. And this is something that Mamiya has spoken out against, you know, so much. The prisons aren't there for the rich and the affluent, because they can pay for the best lawyers and, you know, get the best legal advice and counsel and so forth. But for the majority of us, that is not the case. And so, because Mamiya is political and has spoken out against all of these different issues, he is seen as a threat by the racist status quo in this country. And so whether you believe or whether you agree with Mamiya's beliefs or not, that is not the issue. The issue is the fact that this government feels that they can just silence anybody who has a different opinion. And that's what they're trying to do to Mamiya. And that's why it's important for them, for not only the movement, but for socially conscious people, people who, justice loving people, need to take up this case. Because clearly, there is a conspiracy going on in Philadelphia and around the country to cover up police misconduct, to cover up police brutality. The fact Faulkner was killed by Beverly, you know, because apparently Faulkner had a lot of dirt about a lot of police corruption going on in the Philadelphia Police Department, where prostitution and drugs were concerned, and they felt they had to silence him. And so what do? They frame someone like Mumia, because, you know, of who he is and his stance against police brutality. So anyway, so it's very important for people to seriously look at this case and understand what is really behind this railroad of a political person. So anybody who is interested in finding out more information about Mumia, wants to get involved with the campaign to free Mumia, they can contact International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal at 215-476-8812. They can contact the International Action Centers. We have different chapters around the country, but two of the most prominent are the Philadelphia chapter, which is 215-724-1618, and our national International Action Campaign office is in New York, and that number is 212-633-6646.
All right, Monica Moorhead, I want to thank you for taking this time out of your schedule to join us here on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
It's been my pleasure.
And we'll see you in Philadelphia.
Yeah, see you on August
on the 17th. All right.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Once again, you're tuned to a Thursday special edition of Rockin' the Boat here on August 2nd, 2001. My name is V-Man, and this is Free Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California. On the web, www.microradio.net/FRSC. Please send any and all donations today to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And leave the payable to line blank on those checks. We do accept cash, toilet paper, checks with the payable to lines blank, equipment, and words of encouragement. Once again, P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. To leave your comments on our voicemail, call 831-427-4523. Comments will be aired unless otherwise specified. 831-427-4523. And once again, online at www.microradio.net/FRSC. We've been talking about Mumia Abu-Jamal's case today, and hearing music as well, somewhat related to the aforementioned case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. To recap, I want to thank Monica Moorhead of the International Action Center for joining us and giving us an update on the case. Again, Judge Yan has issued a negative ruling in the case in the federal habeas corpus appeal. His attorneys also filed a motion and are having a hearing August 17th in Philadelphia. Mumia Abu-Jamal will be present at that hearing in the state courts, and there will be a mass march and rally in the streets of Philadelphia on Friday, August 17th, 2001. If you can get there, get to Philly. The Criminal Justice Building, 13th and Filbert Streets, Common Pleas Court Judge Dembe will hear arguments as to how the case should proceed. Mumia will be in court for the first time since 1996. He needs a massive show of support on this day. Protest the corruption in his case and the unjust July 19th ruling by Judge Yan. Rally while Mumia is in court. And then march on Market Street to the federal building. The International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia will know the time soon. Call them at 215-476-8812. That's 215-476-8812. For those of you on the left coast, there will be a press conference and picket line in San Francisco at 12 noon at the State Building, Van Ness and McAllister, San Francisco, California. That's on Friday, August 17th, 12 noon at the State Building at Van Ness and McAllister in San Francisco. If you're not traveling to Philadelphia, come to SF and help make a massive show of solidarity with Mumia and the protesters in Philly, where Mumia is in court. Bring signs. And then in San Francisco on the 18th, Saturday, August 18th, 2001, there will be a rally, mass march and rally in the streets of San Francisco at Powell and Market Streets in San Francisco. Come hear the outcome of Mumia's August 17th court hearing and demonstrate for Mumia's release. For more info, contact www.freemumia.org. That's www.freemumia.org. Thanks for listening. And free Mumia.